Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Tim Bradner of the Alaska Journal of Commerce, Alexandra Gutierrez of APRN, who is joining us from Juneau by Skype, and Dasha Eaton of KSKA Radio. Tim, a Russian company, signs an agreement for a stake in the Point Thompson oil and gas project. This move turned, specifically in this case, gas, this move turned a lot of heads among those in the industry. Why did Rosneft, the Russian company, become involved in the North Slope, and why now?
Well, Mike, this is part of a broader deal between Exxon and Rosneft. It's Arctic-wide, which is interesting. Exxon is taking
meaning
a position.
The Soviet Arctic.
Soviet Arctic, right. This is Exxon taking a position in a lot of projects in the Arctic that Rosneft is doing, including a large proposed LNG project in Vladivostok at the top of the Pacific Rim, which in a way would compete with our project here. Rosneft, in turn, is taking an option in the Point Thompson gas project, which would be part of our LNG project. So it's kind of a commercial deal. Remember, it's easy to try to read too much into this. It's a private deal. You know, it's an option. It may not happen. They have till 2014 to exercise it. You know, I'm told that this is a way, really, for Rosneft to get a kind of a foothold in North America, to get experience in doing business within the U.S. in a major energy project. Whether it helps or hurts our LNG project, who knows?
Well, if I understand it correctly, this is an investment. Is that correct? I mean, it's not like they're going to start building pipelines and doing all kinds of construction work.
It's an investment. They would be a partner in the Point Thompson and potentially a partner in our Alaska LNG project, too. So in a sense, it's good. I mean, Rosneft is a huge company with a lot of cash reserves. People will look at it and say, well, you know, they're competing with us. And Exxon opens up Exxon to investing in a competing project. But Exxon and these companies also have competing projects all over the place. So it's hard to say. It may be good.
And is there any way to know how long it would take for this to play out or to the point that we learn some major piece of information about what's happening?
Well, they have the option to do it till 2014. The state will have to approve the deal. The state will have to approve the transfer of ownership of the state oil leases at Point Thompson, so the Department of Natural Resources will look over the deal. But okay. when it becomes a deal, what's interesting is I learned that the state wasn't informed of it until just a few hours before it was publicly announced.
Okay, so that may tell us something in itself.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, in Juneau, we've heard so much about Governor Parnell, Sean Parnell's attempts to change the oil tax regime we have, to reform ACES, as he calls it. But a minority Democrats have offered their own version of so-called oil tax reform. Alexandra, you're on the scene in the Capitol. What are the Democrats saying in their version of let's change oil taxes, but perhaps not too much?
Well, they're pitching it as an alternative to the governor's plan, which they've been pretty opposed to. Since they're in the minority, it's possible that it won't even be scheduled for a committee hearing, but it lets Democrats go out to the public and say, hey, here's a program, here's our version of what we think the tax structure should look like, instead of just railing against the governor's bill. It also puts a few ideas forward for credits out there that they could try to get incorporated into the governor's bill as it winds through the legislature. As far as what the minorities bill does, it modifies the current system more than anything else. The governor's bill gets rid of progressivity, which is a tax mechanism that works sort of like a sliding scale, raising taxes on oil companies as the price per barrel goes up. The Democrats hate that. So what their bill does is it brings the cap on progressivity down from 50% to 30%. Their bill also exempts 20% of the oil produced from new fields from taxes, and it creates a few new credits to promote heavy oil research and increase production on legacy fields.
If I might ask you, is this bill ever going to get a hearing, or is this strictly open caucuses to the public, press releases, and amendments from the floor? Do you know, or do we know yet?
Well, I'm sure the Democrats would like to get a hearing on it. Obviously, being in the position where they are in, they don't have the advantage. So I would be, it'll be interesting to see.
Okay, thank you. Tim Bradner, if this turns out to be political theater, what is happening with Governor Parnell's bill and when might we see some movement?
Well, the resources committees in both the House and Senate are working hard on this. They've had 3 days of hearings last week, long hearings, three more days this week, and they're scheduled three more days next week. So I'm told that probably the week after that, maybe 2 weeks from now, they'll start doing markup. I have to say that there's a lot of churning in the Senate, in the Republicans' majorities on different ideas. I mean, they're not going to take the governor's bill as it's written. A lot of the ideas that Democrats actually have put forth, or some Republicans are also thinking about, keeping some element of progressivity, some element of the tax credits. So who knows what this is going to look like in the end. It's very much in a state of flux right now.
Okay. Tim, I wanted to ask you, has anybody in the Senate emerged as a leader on this issue in the way that Senator Pascavan, who's now not in the legislature anymore, he's defeated, but has anybody emerged as a kind of leader in this debate?
Yeah, I think it's too early to see that, Mike. Last week, the bill went through the special Senate Committee on TAPS throughput, which is like a precursor of its appearing in the Resources Committee. But there were some strong people on that committee, and it was interesting to me that Senator Anna Faircloth of Anchorage, a moderate Republican, was somewhat critical of some of the ideas in the governor's bill. So I think we're going to, it's hard to say who the leader is, but we know that there are independent thinkers out there.
Okay. This, so. Let's return to Anchorage, where Mayor Dan Sullivan unveils a surprise labor law bill that will diminish the power of municipal unions here in the Anchorage area. Daisha, you've been following this. You went to the assembly and heard a whole lot of talk and seen the legislation. Tell us about this surprising move by the mayor.
Well, the story goes that the mayor sent out an email late Friday, about 4:55, to department heads and union leaders, telling them that this was coming down the line. And then on Monday, he met with them briefly to explain it and give a presentation. And then Tuesday night, it was introduced at the assembly, and we were trying to count how many people were there. I was there. We thought hundreds, but by the end of the night, it looked like around 1,000. And I talked with union leaders, and they said that they were taking signatures of people as they came in. And it was about 1,200 signatures that they gathered. And people were coming and going, so it's hard to say. But it was a lot of people, not all just municipal employees. There were people from unions out in the valley. There were teachers there supporting the municipal employees. So this is basically a revision of the law about the agreement with labor unions and how they function with the municipality. The mayor says he wants sound financial policies, and he calls this managed competition. The unions say he's trying to bust them up.
Now, the managed competition, I assume that means, as in sites Indianapolis and other places or has in the past, means that you're privatizing part of the workforce, right?
Yes, and that is certainly an intention of this change. Now, some departments would not fall under the managed competition program. They would be police officers and firefighters. But that's not to say that parts of their organizations might not be
Like clerical or something?
Well, not just clerical. I mean, there's talk of possibly the ambulances being privatized or something like that. So services certainly could be impacted, and that's what people are concerned about.
Okay. Meanwhile, Assembly Chair Ernie Hall is saying, be patient, this is not over, we've got miles to travel. What did you make of that?
Well, I think, frankly, everybody was pretty surprised by the numbers that did show up. They expected numbers, but maybe not 1,000 people. Those people are going to be at the public hearing, which is scheduled for the 26th, and many of them, maybe even more, we don't know. And they're going to want to give public testimony. That's going to take a while. Ernie Hall says at least two or three assembly meetings. At the same time, the municipality and the assembly really want to get this taken care of because union negotiations are coming up, and they're supposed to begin the end of March, beginning of April, for an agreement that expires. It's a couple of agreements that expire at the end of June.
And this, if I understand this correctly from what I've heard, Mayor Sullivan, the assembly could act pretty expeditiously within less than a month, right?
There was talk that the mayor wanted to get this done in the next few weeks. I spoke with him on the phone, and he said that he wanted to take care of it in a timely manner. We'll see how all this public testimony goes. It has a lot to do with the conversation between the public and the assembly. You know, there's a lot at stake for municipal employees. Their pay could be impacted. Under the agreement that the mayor proposed, there would be basically a locked-in pay for workers that was linked to the Consumer Price Index, looking back
CPI.
5 years.
Yeah.
So they're concerned about that. They're also concerned about changes to seniority and scheduling and how they're paid according to that.
So for them, this is a very big issue. Very, very big.
Yeah, and it's not just pay. It's also benefits as
well.
Okay.
Let's go back to Juno for Alexandra. The cruise ship wastewater bill is moving rapidly, if not smoothly, through the legislature, through the Senate in this case. And the Democrats offered some amendments. They didn't have much luck, but they did raise a debate, didn't they?
They certainly did. So the bill right now is scheduled to come back Tuesday. That's interesting in itself because the Department of Environmental Conservation had previously said, hey, we need to get this done by Friday, February 15th, if we're going to actually permit vessels under this system. So they've kind of hit a roadblock now in the Senate. And so as far as whether they're going to get that new regime, that's unclear right now. The bill came on the floor Wednesday for amendments, and a couple of the members of the majority actually broke with their caucus to support some of those. The one that got the most support was one that would have essentially kept the current standards in place, but it would have just given the cruise ships an extra 5 years to meet the stricter standards that are coming down the pipeline. That amendment has been supported by members of the fishing industry, tribal organizations, and also the backers of the Citizens Initiative that this bill essentially rolls back part of. 10 Republicans in the majority opposed the amendment, and then 5 Democrats in the minority supported it as expected, and then 2 Democrats in the minority broke with them. In fact, one of the minority Democrats was one of the sponsors of this amendment, Senator Dennis Egan of Juneau. And then most interestingly, it was actually 3 majority Democrats. Sorry about that. 2 of them were absent, but expected to support the bill. But what was interesting is actually that 2 majority Republicans from coastal communities, Senator Peter Michicki of Soldotna and Senator Bert Stemmett of Sitka, voted for the amendment. Ultimately got a 10-7 vote, failing, which 10-7 doesn't sound like a good figure to get. But if the bill itself had received a 10-7 vote, it wouldn't have passed. So it needs 11 votes, and it'll be interesting to see if the 11th vote comes on Tuesday.
Are they going to calendar it Tuesday for final passage, or how are they going to handle that?
It comes back as a third reading. It could come back for more amendments.
Right, right.
But a vote is expected that day.
Okay. Tim Bradner, Shell Oil, in quite a surprise, is sending the damaged oil rig Kulleh to Asia, an unspecified destination in Asia, for repairs. Why?
Mike, I think this signals that there's more damage to the Kulleh than has been let on. When the drill ship grounded on the December 31 in a storm, it's never been clear how much damage there was. We know there was damage to the electrical systems from water and the top side from wave action, but Shell has always been very cautious about what exactly, if any, damage there was to the hull. And they say damage was consistent with grounding, whatever that quite means. But in any event, the thing is that the rig is in good enough shape to be towed. They feel, though, they have to take it to a shipyard that's large enough and has the right equipment, and that apparently is Asia. Maybe they couldn't get a U.S. Northwest shipyard scheduled in time, or who knows. But that's going to be a delay for Shell. They also are going to take the Noble Discover, the other drill ship,
right,
to Asia also. And they're going to move them on heavy lift vessels that come in and submerge and pick up the whole thing.
Are you enough of a sea captain to tell us how long this all might take?
Well, the Kulleh is due to leave any day at the bay in Kodiak, and it's going to take 10 days to Dutch Harbor. And there it'll meet the heavy lift vessel.
A lot of logistics.
Yeah, a lot of logistics. Yeah. And then they have to get to Asia. They have to inspect it again. They have to repair it. The big question in everybody's mind is, can they get these rigs repaired and back to the Arctic in time for the 2013 season. And Shell is making no comments about that. We don't know until we know what the schedules are likely to be. But you have to have, Shell has to have two drill ships in the Arctic. They have to have one as standby. So each one stands as the standby for the other.
One of the things that's noticeable about this story to me, Tim, is that this is a story of Shell, to the extent that they've had problems, they are very serious. These seem to be a combination of their own making and a certain amount of bad luck. There's nothing in here about, at least as far as I've heard of it, about overregulation or Greenpeace or lawsuits. This is about sort of a plan they had that didn't work out for moving this vessel or these vessels.
Well, there is a certain amount of things that have been imposed on Shell. For example, the two drilling rig requirement is unique to the Arctic. Okay. The Gulf of Mexico doesn't have that, even after the Deepwater Horizon, because there's lots of other rigs around the Gulf of Mexico. So I guess we shouldn't be surprised. But that's but it's not just two drill rigs. The rigs under the federal rules have to be approved and permitted for Arctic conditions. And that's a big deal, particularly the air permit. So that's the reason why these two rigs are important, because both of these have all the right permits.
And you're indicating here is there are no immediate alternatives.
Well, not that we know of.
Yeah, okay.
I'm sure Shell is scouring, looking for options.
Okay, Daisha Eaton, the filing date for the assembly and the school board has passed. It came last Friday, a week ago. Today we're broadcasting on Friday. What does the field look like as we now enter this? Looks like it's going to be a highly contested election because of the union matters.
Here we go again. Seat A, Don Smith is up for re-election here. He's running, and Betty Davis, former Democratic senator, is...
who we had on this show on running.
Right, and she's been with us many times. She is running against Don Smith. That should be interesting. Obviously, Don is fairly conservative. Betty is, you know, dyed-in-the-wool Democrat. Really has done a lot to fight for children and education. So at a time of budget cuts and flat funding, it'll be interesting to see what she has to say. And also Star Marcette is also running against both of them. She also ran last year for another seat. Seat B, Jeannie Mackey, the president, is also, her seat's up, but she is not running. Eric Croft, former state house member who ran for governor and lost, he's an attorney, he is running. David Neese, former math teacher, he's run before, and Stephanie Cromwell, who worked for ASD until 2012 and works in special ed administration. Assembly. Looks like seat A, Eagle River Chugiak, that's W.O. Sanders' seat, is up. Pete Mulcahy, a retired post commander from Fort Richardson, is running for that seat. He's also the current commissioner of the Planning and Zoning Commission and was appointed by Mayor Sullivan. Amy Demboski, the chair of Chugiak Eagle River Community
Council. I've seen her signs already that surprised me.
Yeah, she's out there and she's vocal. She's also testified at assembly meetings where I saw her. She's definitely given it a shot. And Bob Lupo, perennial candidate, running. Seat E, West Anchorage, that was left by Harriet Drummond in January when she became a state representative, is right now occupied by Cheryl Frasca. She was appointed by the assembly and also appointed by the mayor to his education nonprofit. She's sitting in there until April. She's also running. Tim Steele, a former school board member, is running for that seat, as well as Phil Isley, a perennial candidate. And then there's seat F, Midtown, Dick Traney. He's currently in there. And Andy Clary is challenging him. He's endorsed by Mayor Sullivan and a member of the City Budget Advisory Commission. Seat J, Midtown Anchorage, Jennifer Johnston is currently in that seat, and Jim Cottrell is running against her. Seat H, Paul Honeman, unchallenged, and seat D, Ernie Hall, also unchallenged.
Thank you for that roundup of the municipal races here in Anchorage. Alexandra, conservatives' efforts to move legislation that would expand school choice through charter schools and provide aid to parochial schools is getting a lot of legislative attention this year in the Capitol. Give us a clear view of the landscape and what is coming next.
Well, you're right that it is getting a lot of attention this morning, Friday morning, during the House Majority Caucus. I had most of their members come out and lay out their guiding principles for how they're going to try to get their legislation through this year and what sort of legislation they're looking at. And one of the things they focused on was increasing educational options and vouchers falls into that. Today on the Senate floor, there was kind of a little bit of a kerfuffle when the majority basically made it so that their constitutional, their resolution would allow for a constitutional amendment to allow religious schools to receive state funding. They made it so it doesn't have to go through the Education Committee, it just has to go through the Judiciary Committee and the Finance Committee. And what that means is they're showing that they want to see this move through quickly. They don't want it to get bogged down in more committee hearings.
Alexander, right. If I might, I can't give you the high sign here, but if I might interrupt you just briefly for a question. What about the aid to parochial schools? It could take different forms, but it is going to require a constitutional amendment. And virtually anybody who pays attention to knows that's a high beam to jump over. Yeah.
So on Wednesday, the House Education, the Senate Education, the House Judiciary, and the Senate Judiciary committees, they all got together and they had a few experts on school choice attorneys. One former DC council member who served in the Obama administration who's come out in support of vouchers, they all got together and they kind of explained, hey, here's what you need to do to make sure you can have vouchers pass. They say that the state Supreme Court has misread the Blaine Amendment, which prohibits any direct funding of religious schools. They say that vouchers are indirect, so it shouldn't matter. But given the way the court has ruled on this, they need to change the Constitution. So we've got a legislature that's friendlier to this amendment, but it would still need to go to a public vote. So it's unclear whether they would actually see the Constitution amended so pass the Constitution amendment so schools can receive vouchers that are religious in nature.
And finally, we should note that this is only the first year of this legislature's session, so they have all of next year to work on this as well as this year. Thank you. Tim, it appears that Congress and the president aren't going to be able to agree on a budget, that we are going to have the so-called sequester, and that it's just going to be major parts of the federal government are going to be affected, and they're going to lose money to operate in a short period of time by the first of the month. How's Alaska going to be affected by this?
Michael, it's totally unknown territory. We have no idea.
But it's my understanding some government agencies are making preparations what they will do if they don't have the money.
They are. It's really premature to say just what the impacts would be. You have to think that probably it's going to be gradual, a little bit gradual. It won't be a sudden shock to the system, but it's going to be there, and we're going to feel it.
And once again, this speaks to the general confidence in the government in Washington, the ability to, if we're going to have trouble paying our bills, what's next?
Yeah, no kidding. But we'll have to see. I mean, we come up to the edge of the abyss before and drawn back.
We've come to the edge of the abyss and not quite gone over, but got close. Alexander, the Republican Party battle over its chairmanship continues. And the leadership decision, the leaders took a decision to oust the chairman, Russ Millett. But he's still making waves in the Capitol. The Central Committee met in Juneau last weekend, and you had a chance to take a look.
It was an interesting meeting for sure. So it was Debbie Brown, the new chairperson's first chance to head a meeting, and she had gone through her own sort of drama. She had been accused of mismanaging district funds, she ultimately managed to stay on. So the meeting was a little bit disorganized in terms of her trying to figure out just how to, just get through the basic process of running this stuff. And she also tried to appoint her own treasurer and assistant treasurer so she could have more control over the funds. Recently, a lot of the Republican Party's funds were moved to the Capital City Republican Woman as a way to kind of give the Russ Millett and Debbie Brown faction less control over what the party could do. And then, interestingly, in the middle of the meeting, they got an email from Russ Millett saying, hey, I'm going to appeal. What you did was an illegal action. I hadn't actually become chair yet, so you can't remove me from that. And so his appeal will be scheduled to be heard in May in Homer when they meet next time.
One of the striking things is the Republican Party is so dominant here in Alaska, yet they have such a fractured leadership. I suspect that when you become the dominant party, and they've been dominant in the House for more than 20 years now, this is what happens. The factions show up in your own group. You start fighting among yourselves, not just with the Democrats.
Right. I mean, if your tent is so big that it includes everyone, there's going to be a diversity of opinion. And now we've really seen that in terms of the supporters of the Ron Paul and Tea Party movements versus the traditional establishment folk who have been running the party for a while.
Tim, very quickly, Governor Parnell says a bill that would bring LNG from the North Slope to Fairbanks by truck is a necessity and must pass this year. Could this happen?
I think it could, Mike. This is a big deal for Fairbanks. The Fairbanks delegation is solid on this. The governor is really committed to it. The idea is to have a modest-sized LNG plant at Prudhoe Bay and ship the LNG by truck to Fairbanks. Remember that we're doing this now from Anchorage. There is a small LNG plant in the Mat-Su Valley, and Fairbanks Natural Gas trucks the stuff up the pipeline.
Okay, we got one more piece of information before we say goodnight, and that is I attended Neil Fried, the economist's projection of the future of Anchorage's economy next year, and had one really important piece of information. There are 165,000 pickups in Anchorage. Good night.
If you have questions or comments about the program,
I'm about to get
that.
Email
alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org. Or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.